pray in this way. The eighth talk in a series on the Sermon on the Mount was presented by Ron Julian on August 22, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good afternoon. We're in the eighth week of our series in the Sermon on the Mount. We're in Matthew chapter 6 today. I like this section very much. I kind of think of it as having layers within layers, like an onion. There's this outer layer about religious hypocrisy. Then inside that is a layer dealing with prayer, and at the heart of that is the Bible's most important teaching on prayer, the Lord's Prayer. So let me tell you the choice that I faced when I came to this. And it was a hard choice, and I went back and forth, and I'm still wondering whether I made the right choice, but the choice has been made, so we will live with it. The thing is that with the Lord's Prayer, which is a part of what we're looking at here, we could easily, profitably spend a week on each of the lines in the Lord's Prayer, going through and talking about what's going on there, talking about some of the options for how to understand things and the implications of that, and that would be a very profitable thing to do. And maybe someday, if ever do a series on prayer or something like that, might come back and just kind of do that and go through it step by step. But I'm wanting to get through the whole Sermon on the Mount here this summer, so I decided instead that we're going to take this whole section on as a section and try to get sort of the overall picture of what's going on. So that means that there are a number of details that I'm going to sort of lightly touch or not at all touch, which you are welcome to raise as issues in the questions when we get to the end. It's not that I don't have opinions on those things or arguments to make, but I wanted to try to kind of get the overall picture. So we'll see how that works. So we'll start with the outer layer here. In 6:1, Jesus says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." Okay, so by practicing your righteousness here, Jesus means, as we will see, anything that we might do out of a religious motivation, anything we might do because we have this idea that it is pleasing to God. He's about to give three examples that have a very parallel structure, as we'll see. He's going to talk about giving alms and praying and fasting. And the essential question that he's asking in each of these is, why are you doing it? Are you doing it so that God will be pleased with you, or are you doing it so that other people will be pleased with you? Now, we don't want to stumble over this language. He talks about having a reward with God, and that can sound troubling. What exactly are we talking about there? We're Protestants, after all. We don't believe in earning your salvation or having any merit before God. It's not that God owes us anything, so what's this reward stuff? Because that language, reward, sounds a lot like somebody owes you something. I mean, you go and do something, and then you get your reward for having done this good thing. But that's not the idea, I don't think. I'm reminded of that language in Hebrews. The one who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. That is, he responds graciously to those who seek him. If God were not a rewarder of those who seek him, then when we came to him, he would say, "Go away. I'm not interested. I have nothing for you. Go find some other god somewhere." Well, that's not what he does. Instead, when we seek God in belief, he responds graciously. He accepts us and offers forgiveness and restoration and so forth. So this forgiveness and restoration, the whole package that we call salvation, is our reward for seeking God. But it's not that we earned something and we've deserved it. By reward, it really just means something like the desired outcome. You know, your reward for getting an air conditioner in your house is that now it's cool. I mean, you're seeking something and you got it. So reward here is just the result that you were hoping for. You went to God and you were hoping for him to respond in some way, and either he does or he doesn't. So here's what Jesus is confronting us with here. When I'm doing various religious things, what sort of a response am I looking for? What reward am I looking for? Do I want men to notice and give me their approval? Is the reward I'm looking for what I can gain in this life through the approval of other people? Or is the reward I'm looking for what God has to offer ultimately? So that's the situation. Jesus is going to give us three very parallel examples here. Let me clarify something about these examples that we're about to look at. Each of the three activities that Jesus is about to discuss has a specifically religious motivation. Two of them, giving alms and fasting, could be done without any religious motivation at all. There are plenty of people who don't believe in God who will give charity out of compassion to somebody who is in need. There are plenty of people who don't believe in God who will fast for health reasons, or they'll fast for some vaguely spiritual idea that I'm connecting with the universe, or, you know, whatever it might be. You don't have to believe in God to do those things. But Jesus is not talking about them from that perspective. He's talking about them from the perspective of a pious, godly Jew of the time. And that pious, godly Jew was expected to give charity to the poor, to pray, and to fast. It was part of the religious life of Israel. He was supposed to do this not only because charity is a kind thing to do for someone who's in need, or that fasting is good for your body, although it may be. He was supposed to do this because it was part of his religious expression before God. God was asking him to do things like that, and he did it as a deliberate expression of his obedience and devotion to God. It's from that perspective that Jesus is talking about these practices. So it may sound strange to talk about the reward you get for giving alms, for giving charity. Don't you give charity because somebody needs something and you're just being compassionate and you're helping them? Well, yes, that can be a reason to do it, but what we're looking at now is from the perspective of Jewish religious life, the idea that I am setting out to do certain things because I believe in God and as an expression of my belief in God. Okay. And I might say, we're going to look at these three examples, almsgiving, prayer, and fasting. My real concern today is going to be that middle one, the prayer, because that's the one that he goes on to expand on. We'll look at these three quickly to see the pattern that he's talking about, the issue of religious hypocrisy. It's not hard to see what he's getting at here, I think. And then we're going to focus in on the issue of prayer. And that's mostly because that's the issue that he himself focuses in on here, and partly because I don't really have anything to say about almsgiving and fasting. As a Jewish practice, as a part of the religion, that's great. I have no advice to give you as to how you ought to do that or whether you ought to do that. And that's not really the point. I mean, what Jesus is saying here is assuming that he's talking to Jews who in fact do these things. And so how you do it, what your motivation is in doing it, is really his concern. Okay, so we'll look at the first one, 6:2. When therefore you give alms, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be honored by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Okay, so the question here is, when you are fulfilling your religious obligation to God and giving alms, what is your real motive? Supposedly, the almsgiver is demonstrating his devotion to God. But the hypocrites are, in fact, not really concerned with God's reaction. They're looking for the approval of the crowd. There is a lot to be gained in this life by being a person that the religious community around you approves of. You live in a certain way, and people say, oh, yeah, you're one of the good guys. And being seen as one of the good guys can be of a great benefit in this life. I mean, we all recognize that that's the case. In a very important phrase here, Jesus says, they have their reward in full. That is, they got what they were looking for. They were looking for the religious community around them to embrace them and say, yes, you're one of the good guys, we like you. That's what they wanted, that's what they got. So they got their reward in full. Although the activity they were involved in was supposedly about God in some way, in fact, God was actually irrelevant to it. What they really wanted was the response from the people. Now, in fact, what their motivation in theory was supposed to be about was a desire to be faithful to God, to seek his approval of their actions, to live in a way that's in keeping with what he wanted from them. Okay, so Jesus proposes, let's think about this now. Let's find a way to test how it is you feel about this. What is your actual goal when you're doing this? So he uses this, what I think is a very funny picture of don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Well, because part of the problem that we face here is not only can it be beneficial to us in this life to have the approval of everyone else, but there can also be this other sort of motivation that I can approve of myself as a very pious person, so that everybody's seeing this great, generous, pious, religious almsgiver, and I can feel like I'm a really great guy because I'm doing that. So Jesus uses this language, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. If you could, you should give in such a way that you don't even know that you're doing it. So you can tell the motivation is not the reward of being seen by everybody else and even myself as a pious person, but what I was actually doing it for is because God had called me to do it, and that's what led me to do it in the first place. So, the issue is, do you want the approval of God or the approval of men, including yourself? Right, then we have the second example. Different issue, but it's exactly the same picture. And when you pray, verse 5, when you pray, you are not to be as the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners in order to be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you pray, go into your inner room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. Okay, same pattern that we saw before. Prayer, obviously, is supposed to be about seeking something from God. I mean, why am I? This is about God, right? I'm praying to God. So it must be that I have some business to do with God is why I'm doing it. But, again, our motivation can, in fact, be to seek the approval of men, to be seen as a pious person who is praying to God, because prayer is approved of, as that's one of the activities that a pious person does. So, again, you can kind of test yourself. Do all your praying in the inner room. Go into that part of the house that is most private and pray there, so nobody knows that you're doing it. Would you still want to, a sort of implication, if nobody knew that you were doing it? Now, I want to skip here. He's going to say some more stuff about prayer, which we can come back to in a minute, but we'll finish out the three parallel teachings here by jumping to verse 16, where he says, and whenever you fast, Do not put on a gloomy face, as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance in order to be seen fasting by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, so that you may not be seen fasting by men, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. It has just crossed my mind that I should probably, in fairness, mention that, I mean, the hypocrites that he's talking about here, it's not hard to see some of the Pharisees as being the target that he's talking about here. But it's always important to recognize that it was a complex picture, that the Pharisees themselves had different perspectives on some of these things. And we do have rabbinic writings that are like this example, where they're saying the same sort of thing, where they recognized that sort of abuse, where religion was being used as a way of putting on a pious show instead of actually being for its intended purpose. So Jesus isn't the only one who is saying these things. But it really does seem to be the case that the big voices, the leadership among the Pharisees, as portrayed in the New Testament, really were practicing these kinds of things. Okay, so again, we see the same pattern here. The religious activity, this time fasting, done supposedly out of obedience to God, out of some sort of sense that this has something to do with my relationship with God, and yet the motivation can in fact be the honor that comes to me as being a pious person. Oh, look at him. He's really suffering in his fasting. He must really love God. And so one way to guard against that is spruce yourself up and don't give any indication that you're fasting. Nobody knows that you're doing it. God, if you really have in mind that you're dealing with God, he knows. You can't go anywhere where you're going to hide from him. And isn't he the one that this is all about? So think about it that way. All right, so the three examples that he gives here, almsgiving, prayer, and fasting, in each case, he's giving the same sort of thing. And the key phrase is, they have their reward in full. What reward were you looking for? What result were you looking for in doing this? And there is an approach to religion where the result that I'm looking for is very much in this world, where I can be approved of as a pious person. And Jesus is very much warning against that. Okay, so one of the things he talks about here is prayer. And on the topic of prayer, he goes on to say more about it that gets away from this topic of religious hypocrisy and actually starts to say some other things about prayer. So that's what we want to look at now. So if we'll forget about almsgiving and fasting for now, concentrate on prayer. And so we've seen our first lesson that Jesus has on prayer is that, first of all, prayer is supposed to be about your relationship with God and not about gaining favor with other people. Now, that's not the only problem you can have when it comes to prayer. There are plenty of people who are in their praying actually are concerned with not what other people think of them, but with getting something from God. That doesn't necessarily mean that you've got it right either. And that brings us to the next thing that he says in verses 7 and 8. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. Therefore, do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Okay, so obviously here the pagan Gentiles that he's describing genuinely want God or the gods or somebody to give them something. That's why they're praying. They're not praying to impress their neighbors, at least not the way he's describing it right here. They are praying because there's something they want. They want rain for their crops, or they want healthy children, or food on the table, or something like that. And they're looking to figure out, how can we get the powers that be to give us what we want? There's no rain. How can I get the big kahuna up there to decide that rain ought to come my way? That's so we're talking about people who want some response from whoever that is up there. But Jesus doesn't commend them for it just because they want something from God. I mean, they have their attention turned in the right direction, but there's something very wrong with their approach to prayer here as well. Now, the issue is, what is it that's wrong? What is he talking about? From that language, do not use meaningless repetition. Sometimes we sort of get the impression that the issue is a matter of style here. You shouldn't be making long prayers and keep saying over and over again what it is you want or something like that. God doesn't like long prayers. God likes short prayers. Just like people in church like short sermons and not long sermons, God has a short attention span just like we do. So he says, cut to the chase. Just tell me what you want. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit. But we get that idea that somehow that basically what he's involved here is don't go on and on. That's what Jesus is getting at. Well, I don't think that's quite the issue. I think there's something much more important than that in view in what he's saying here. Notice the language. He says, they suppose that they will be heard for their many words. The problem here, I would say, is not with their style, but with their view of God and their motivation in this. The idea is, if we pray in a certain way, we will get heard. How can we get the gods to give us what we want? We are going to use our prayer and our words in some way to make sure that it's most likely that it's going to pay off, that the gods are going to give us what we want. We don't exactly know how to translate the word that the New American Standard has as meaningless repetition here. It's not a word that's used very often. Some argue that something like babbling is a good translation. I think the idea is if you picture a babbling, repetitious prayer that I think is going to make it so that the gods are going to hear me, the picture that Jesus has in mind here is almost one of an incantation, I think. The idea that somehow by the technique that I use in my prayer, by putting my words together in a certain way, I'm going to make sure that God hears me. And so prayer becomes a way to manipulate God. If I put my words together right, then I'm more likely to get the payoff that I'm looking for. And that's what he's warning them against. The problem, then, is this view of God, that he's this sort of cosmic force that I can get to pay off if I structure my words right, if I chant the right thing or intone the right thing or something. Notice that the alternative is, don't be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. This is not some force that can be manipulated by the cleverness of my prayer technique. This is a person like a father who is sovereign, who already knows my situation before I start. We're not talking about the need to somehow manipulate God into paying off. We're talking about a father who knows the situation already. This is a person that I'm dealing with who has a will and a character and already knows more about the situation than I do. So if you understand who God is, then you realize that it is not your place to somehow try to manipulate him into giving you what you think you need. You are like a child going to a father. You take your concerns to him and then wait to see what his wisdom will dictate. That's the picture that Jesus wants to turn us toward. So it strikes me that we're starting to see already that prayer turns out to be an expression of what kind of people we are. How do we think about this God that we're going to? We can be indifferent to God and use prayer as a technique to gain the religious approval of other people. Or we can think of God as some kind of a force to be manipulated and use the technique of our prayer to somehow get him to pay off. Or else we can be a different kind of people and approach God with understanding and humility, approach God the way we should approach him. And I think that's exactly what the Lord's Prayer then that Jesus is going to go on to give here, what we call the Lord's Prayer, is intended to do. This is Jesus showing us how we should think about God and ourselves as we come to God in prayer. Notice he starts out in verse 9, pray then in this way. He's giving this model. This is the kind of thing that I should come to God with. This is the sort of person I should be when I come to God. What you see reflected in the concerns in this prayer should be the concerns of the person who's coming to God. We pray then in this way, our Father who is in heaven. So right off we see the difference between that idea that somehow I'm going to use my magic words to manipulate God into giving me something. No, I'm praying to my Father in heaven. Again, an individual, a person, like my Father. He gave me life, and he is the one to go to when I am in need. And yet, he's the one with the wisdom and the power in the situation. It is to me to go to him, tell him my situation. It is for him, in his wisdom, to determine what he's going to do, the way a child would be with a father. Now, so we come to the prayer, very famous prayer. I would be real surprised if you haven't heard it before. Most of us have probably recited it many times. Like I said, I'm going to try to just sort of step back and give an overview of this, and I hope that's not a mistake, because there are a number of details that we could talk about. But I want to sort of get this overall picture so we can see the progression of thought here as we're looking at this idea of prayer. So, prayer divides into two halves. In the first half, I would argue we have three parallel statements, each having exactly the same structure. And in the typical translation of it that we usually recite, it's not so obvious that that's the case. So let me translate this more literally so that it becomes clearer, the structural parallel that I'm talking about. The beginning of the Lord's Prayer is, may your name be sanctified, may your kingdom come, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So there's this very clear structural similarity between them. May your something do something. May your name be sanctified. May your kingdom come. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And I would argue that they're structurally identical because they are closely related to each other. Each of these three lines is basically getting at the same sort of thing. To understand how they're related, I want to step back and give a very brief picture of the Old Testament concept of the kingdom of God, because that's really what's informing this language. Okay, that's what I'm going to do. So, in the Old Testament prophets, we often find the theme that there is this time coming when God is going to step into history and the rule of God will extend over all the earth. Right now, evil men are in charge of rebellious nations. The world is a rebellious place. You look around at the way things are, and this is not the way it's supposed to be. The way people are living is not the way people are supposed to be living. The way rulers are ruling, that's not the way the world is supposed to go. But there is a day coming when God is going to break into history and defeat all of the enemies of God and righteousness. In that day, God's rule will be actualized on the earth. God, of course, is king over all his creation, but he has this period of time that we're in where he is letting sin have its reign. He's letting people show what they're made of, and he hasn't stepped in to stop it. It just keeps going on. But the prophetic message is that there is a day when he is going to step in and stop it. All sin and rebellion will cease. All people will know and obey him. And that rule of God will be brought about through the human king, the Messiah, who is going to rule for God. And of course, the opening of the New Testament basically tells us that Jesus of Nazareth is that human king who has come to be that Messiah. So, there are three ways that we could describe the nature of the change that is going to come about on that day as we look at the description in the Old Testament. Today, the world is ruled by evil and fallible men. But one day, the world will be ruled by God and his Messiah. That is why it is called the kingdom of God. Or the rule of God, really, is a way of translating it, perhaps. The idea that the world is going to be a place where God's rule has extended to everything. Secondly, today, evil men violate the moral will of God. There is evil and corruption in the world, and God continues to let that rebellion go on. He hasn't stopped it yet. It's been going on for a long time, and still it continues. But what the prophet said is, one day all rebellion will cease. On that day, God's moral will be reflected in his creation. You look at the earth, you look at people, you look at everything, and what you see there will be a reflection of the way God really wants it to be. Yes, there is this time where there is evil and sin, but there is going to come a time when that is gone. And God's will is going to prevail in the sense that his goodness will be reflected in everything. As Peter puts it in his letter in the New Testament, we will live in a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness dwells. Okay, and then thirdly, we could describe it in this way. Today, evil men mock God or disregard him. God doesn't have a very good reputation in the world right now. But one day, God will intervene in history and demonstrate that he indeed is the holy God that he has always claimed to be. He will demonstrate his goodness and his power, and that what he has been doing with the world has been the right thing to do. One day, everyone will know that God is good and powerful and that his plan for the world is good. Okay, so this day is coming. The rule of evil men will be put down and the rule of God established. Evil and sin will be put aside and righteousness, the moral will of God, will prevail throughout all of creation. And God will finally have vindicated himself, will have shown that he is there, he is good, and that he has known what he's doing all along. Well, so with that picture then, that's my perspective on what the first three requests in the Lord's Prayer are talking about. May your name be sanctified. May your name become known as holy. That is, may all the world see that your name is holy. May all the world come to know you, God, for who you are. May that day come when your name is vindicated, when the holiness of God is seen by everyone. May your kingdom come is the second example. That is, may that day come when all the rulers of this world are thrown down and God and his Messiah are ruling over all the earth. And may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That is, may your rule be extended over a new earth so that everything on that earth reflects your righteousness. May this fallen earth that we know now become a place where your will is totally obeyed. All of those three things are talking about the same thing. What we would call now, with more information in the New Testament, the second coming of Christ, the coming of the Messiah to establish and permanently transform this world into that form that God has always intended ultimately for it to be. God's name will be vindicated, the rule of evil men will be put down, and God's rule will be established over all creation. And his moral perfection will be seen in every aspect of his creation, There will be no sin or rebellion anymore. And I think that's what we're praying for in the beginning of the Lord's Prayer. So, what's that about? Why are we praying that? Why is he saying this is how you should pray? I think the idea is that we are agreeing with God. We are saying that we want what God has always promised that he would do. I mean, these things that we're praying for are not our idea. We're not coming along and saying, hey, God, I have an idea. Why don't you put down all of the evil in the world and extend your rule over everything? I mean, this may not have occurred to you, but doesn't that sound like a good idea? Wouldn't that be better than the way we're doing it right now? That's not the way it works. I mean, we've already been told from the beginning that this is where God is going. It is his intention to redeem and restore the creation. So what we're doing is getting on board with that. We're saying, that's what I want. We want God to vindicate his name and throw down the evil rulers of this world and establish righteousness throughout all of creation. That is what God said he would do, and we're expressing our agreement with that and our desire for the things that he has promised. We recognize that's what I need, that's what the world needs, that's what I'm waiting for, that's what I want. God, you want to know what I want? I don't want a new bicycle for Christmas. I want your kingdom to come. That's what I want. In the second half of the Lord's Prayer, then, we have three requests that focus on life today. I would say in the beginning, I'm saying ultimately, this is what my heart is set on, the things that you have promised. I want that day to come. In the meanwhile, here I am, waiting for that day. What am I asking of God as I live my life in this world? What do I think I need? And we have these three requests that we're taught to make. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we have also forgiven our debtors, and do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. These three requests. As I see it, each of these requests require me to face reality. I am asking for things from the perspective of an understanding of who I am and what I really need and where I stand before God. It requires us to abandon the sort of worldly fog that we all live in and come to terms with God. There are three things that he's talking about here. First of all, and this is controversial, I'm not going to go into that right now. There is another way to take this, and we can talk about it in the question time if you want. But right now, I'm inclined to see this section, the first request, give us this day our daily bread, as basically being motivated by something like this. I have physical needs for food and shelter, but I am inclined to worry and freak out about how they will be fulfilled. Immediately after this section, what we're going to look at next week is the section where Jesus talks about not worrying about the things that you need and the lilies of the field and all of that language, that idea of entrusting myself to the character of God for the things that I need, recognizing that I am dependent on him and that I am called to trust him for those things. Well, I think that's what's behind this first request. I'm not just asking for food, but it is an implicit acknowledgement that I trust God and see him as the source of the things that I need in life. So I know that I need those things, but I'm acknowledging that I trust God to be the provider, ultimately, of what I need. Secondly, I'm an evil man, and if God does not forgive me, I am lost. This is also something I recognize about myself. So I am admitting that I need forgiveness and asking for God to forgive me. We can see that Jesus is very concerned about our attitude here because he adds several things to this that are important. We pray for forgiveness as we have forgiven our debtors, or as we have forgiven those who trespass against us, depending on how you translate it. When I look at the things that people have done to me, the debts that people owe me, the way that people have mistreated me or transgressed against me, it's easy for me to look at those things and to understand there's something wrong there. There's something bad. Jesus explains this more in other places, but the idea is basically, as I look at other people and I clearly understand, yes, there's something wrong there, I am being invited to think of myself in the same terms. You know, my need for forgiveness before God is just the same as theirs. I'm not any better than anybody else. I have this sense of outrage about them and what they have done. Well, that would be appropriately directed toward myself as well. So what I'm saying basically is that I know that I need forgiveness, and I'm willing to recognize my sin as being so serious that it's just like all those other people out there, and I have to acknowledge that they need forgiveness as well. So my willingness to see that it's okay for them to be forgiven is my way of acknowledging the seriousness of my own offense. So that's why he ties the idea, I'm just not asking for forgiveness, I'm also acknowledging, and it is incumbent on me to forgive others because my sins are just as serious as theirs. It's that old thing. If I am going to get mercy, then my sins are just as serious as anyone else's, so they're just as worthy of mercy as I would be, which is to say, not worthy at all. Or, if I really don't think that I have that serious a problem, now, then there's something wrong. I mean, if I make this shift and say somehow those people are bad, they don't deserve mercy, the fact is I haven't understood myself because I've really condemned myself in that. And then I don't deserve it either. And all of that is being hinted at in what Jesus is saying here. So it is my willingness to acknowledge that I really do need mercy because my sins are as serious as the sins of the people who have sinned against me. Now, Jesus obviously thinks that this is a big deal because at the end of the prayer, in verse 14, he emphasizes this point again. He's at the end of the Lord's Prayer. He's done. And then he throws in this thing in verse 14. For if you forgive men for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. And again, it's just as I was saying. I had been better be willing to see myself in the same way I see other people. If their sins don't deserve mercy, then neither do mine. But if my sins are being forgiven in spite of my evil, then their sins can be forgiven in spite of their evil. So in this prayer, I am admitting to God that I am just as big a sinner as anyone else and that I really do need the mercy of God. The third request comes from this place. I am a morally weak man, and if God does not rescue me from my own sin, I will destroy myself. I am praying that God will lead my life in such a way that I do not fall into temptation. And I understand the temptation here to be a fundamental and serious thing that he's talking about, that for to be led into temptation would be to be led into those things that will ultimately seduce me away from God and life itself. Because I could easily do that. I could easily be destroyed by the evil in the world as it sucked me in. So I'm acknowledging to God my weakness and my need for his mercy in that way as well. Don't lead me into temptation, but deliver me from evil. The evil in the world out there is ready to grab me because I am ready to go for it. Don't take my life in that direction. Rescue me from the evil that is out there. I'm admitting that I'm not strong. I am weak. And I'm asking God for rescue. So, in the second half of the Lord's Prayer, it's coming from a certain fundamental perspective about who I am before God and what I need. Lord, I am a vulnerable and powerless man who is not in charge of the world. If you do not provide the physical things I need, I will perish, so I need to trust you for them. Lord, I am a guilty man. If you do not forgive me, I will perish eternally, so I need your forgiveness. Lord, I am a morally weak man. If you do not rescue me from the evil that could ensnare my soul, I will perish eternally. That's what that part of the prayer is about, is this recognition here today, waiting for the kingdom of God. What I need is for God to take care of me and forgive me and keep me from destroying myself by being ensnared by the temptations of evil. That's what I really need. The last line of the prayer is, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen." As you probably know, there's a very strong question as to whether this actually is a part of the original text. A commentator whom I greatly respect argues that it was added later, and many, many scholars agree with him. I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion on that myself, but there's a lot of textual problems with this, you know, in the copying and recopying of the text. There's a serious question as to whether that part actually was a part of what Jesus said. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's a great statement. So if you decide, no, I think Jesus said that, I don't think you're going to get in trouble because it's great. But I have my doubts. Okay, so very quick tour of this complex teaching. This whole section is full of the idea that we are seeking some reward, some gracious response from God. The prayer even that we're talking about here is a prayer where we are expressing to God our desires and needs. God, I need something from you. Please do this. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with the idea that we are going to God looking for something. We are needy people. It is appropriate for us to go to him looking for life, because if he does not give life, we're going to get death instead. There's something right about trusting him and looking to him to be gracious in that way. So nothing wrong with asking for, looking for a gracious response from God, which is what this whole section is about. But the issue is, what kind of people are we in this pursuit? You can think about it here as kind of presenting us with a series of forks in the road as we're supposedly approaching God and looking for something from him. So thinking about prayer, the first fork in the road that I come to is, am I praying because I am really looking for other people to applaud and honor me for my piety? Is it that I enjoy being a religious person? Is that why I'm doing it? Or am I praying to God because I am truly looking for something from him? I believe he's there, and he's the reason I'm praying, because I'm looking for something from him. And Jesus is saying, you need to choose the road of genuinely looking to God for some response from him. It's not about what response you get from the rest of the world. It's about what response do you get from God. So that's our first fork in the road. I want to be looking for some response from God and not from my neighbor. Okay, so I go down that road. Now I come to the next fork in the road. Am I treating God like some cosmic force I can manipulate through the magic words of my prayer? Or do I see him like a father, a person with a will and character, the one who gave me life, the sovereign person who can choose to bless me or not? The source, ultimately, of blessing. The one who already knows what I need. The one to whom I am coming simply to make my needs and desires known. So, which is it? Is he some sort of a force that I can manipulate to get what I want? Or am I actually dependent on the choices of this gracious but powerful and sovereign Father in heaven, who already knows the situation better than I do? Which am I doing? So Jesus wants me to take that fork in the road. I am approaching God as my sovereign, all-knowing Father, coming to him with my concerns. Okay, so but now what's the next fork in the road? Well, what are my concerns? What am I coming for? In the end, if having gotten that far, I come to God and I'm basically like the rest of the world. What I'm looking for is worldly pleasure and wealth and security and power. Hey, God seems to have a lot of power. He's the guy that could be useful to me in my pursuit of getting rich and having everything I want in this life and having pleasure and status and all of that stuff. I mean, there's a whole reward that the world has to offer, and God can be seen as the means to get to that reward. I'm using God to get what I'm looking for in this life ultimately. Or, again, that fork in the road, have I accepted the values and perspective of the God that I'm praying to? Do I understand who he is and what fundamentally is important and who I am and what I need? And that, I think, is what the Lord's Prayer then is about. That Jesus is saying, I want you to, in your prayer, when you're coming to God, to have this perspective on who he is and who you are and what you really need. And what is that perspective? First of all, I want what God has promised. That is, I am longing for the day when God vindicates his name and sends his Messiah to throw down all evil and all evil rulers in the world and establishes righteousness throughout all his creation. That's what I want. I want the day when God makes this world right, including the evil in my own heart. That's what I'm looking for, that day when creation has been redeemed. Meanwhile, while I am waiting, this is how I see my current situation and my current needs. I am dependent on God to graciously provide my physical needs, so I'm going to trust him for that. I am dependent on God to forgive and accept me. Without his forgiveness, I will be lost. And I need to accept that and look for that forgiveness in such fundamentally truthful and honest terms about my real guilt that I see in the sins of others around me, especially the ones against me, that my situation is no different than theirs. We're all in the same boat. We all need the forgiveness of God. And I need to be rescued from the seductive evil of the world that could so easily tempt me to my destruction. I am weak, and I need God to lead my life in such a way that the evil in the world does not suck me in, but I am rescued from it. So, God, take care of my physical needs, forgive me for the evil person that I am, and save me from the seductive power of the world. That's my situation now. That's what I'm asking for. One thing seems very clear to me then. Jesus sees prayer as a test of the kind of person I am. We think about these roads, the forks in the road that I'm talking about. In each case, I had another option. I could have disregarded God altogether. Or I could have seen God as just some kind of a gumball machine that if I use the right incantation, I can get what I want from him. Or I could have come to him as a person, but as a person who shares my values and desires, seeking power and pleasure and security and so forth in this life. Instead of arriving at the heart of, This is how I should come to God because this is the kind of person that I am. There are all kinds of reasons a person might pray. I really think that if you start to understand what the Bible has to say about prayer, we're mistaken to think that the Bible thinks that prayer in and of itself is the goal. Prayer in and of itself is nothing. There's all kinds of prayers in the world, and the Bible itself gives examples of prayers, pious prayers, religious prayers, that in the end, God would say, I'm not particularly interested in that prayer. It may be a prayer, but it's not coming from a place that I'm in favor of. The important thing is that I am a person whose heart is in submission to God. I'm willing to bow to God's vision of what I really need, to see myself for who I am and who he is. I'm willing to admit my weakness and guilt and to look to God to sustain me. That's really what the Lord's Prayer is about, is setting my sights on the thing that God says is going to ultimately be the deliverance of the world, meanwhile recognizing my physical and spiritual weakness and my dependence on God in the midst of that. Now, Are there those the only things we can pray about? I mean, that's the Lord's Prayer. Is that it? Is that exhausted what it would be appropriate to pray about? No, I don't think that's why he's giving it. In fact, we know it's not why he's giving it. We see in the model of his own life that he prays concerning a number of things. We see that discussed in other books of the New Testament as well. In fact, we see the totally mind-boggling picture of Jesus, the Messiah, praying to the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane that he would not have to go to the cross. That is not one of the topics in the Lord's Prayer. That doesn't fit in there somehow. Well, that's a topic for another time. There is another aspect to prayer. There are other things involved in prayer and other kinds of prayers that we might pray. But I think Jesus is getting to the heart of it here. Really, the issue is not being a religious person so that you pray a lot. The heart of it is my heart. The issue is, what sort of a person am I? Do I acknowledge that God is there? Do I see him somewhat, at least, for who he is, for whom he has portrayed himself to be? Have I set my heart on the things that he says are valuable? Am I willing to see myself as the needy person that I am before him? Prayer is fundamentally an expression of my heart's willingness to know the truth about God and myself. Okay, so I'm open for any questions or comments or complaints or recipes or whatever you might have.
A small detail that kind of jumps out at me is when he tells us not to pray like the Gentiles do.
Mm-hmm.
Being one, could he have said, do not pray the way the Pharisees or pagans or unbelievers or sinners do? Or is there some sort of, he's clearly not saying you're okay if you're Jewish, but just don't act like a Gentile, because you're not okay if you're Jewish here.
Right.
So okay. Why do you think of that specific word, Gentile?
Okay. So clearly, when he talks about the hypocrites at the beginning, he's already got his eye on the Pharisees. I mean, he's talking about religious Jews whose motivation in prayer is something different than what it ought to be. So he's already had them in view. Why, to his Jewish audience, would he highlight the fact that this is the way the Gentiles pray? I'm not sure. I mean, possibly. I mean, number one, this was a division that was very Jewish. I mean, us and the nations. I mean, that goes back to the Old Testament. There is the nation of Israel, and there are the nations, which is everybody else. And there's a meaningful distinction there in a lot of ways. I mean, the nation of Israel had been entrusted with the law of God, and the nations had not. So they did not know Yahweh in the way that Israel did, because God had revealed himself and so forth. So that distinction, the Gentiles, when you talk about the Gentiles, those are the ones who don't have the light that we do, so they're ignorant in the way they pursue these things. So it may be kind of a way of saying, you know, this thing that I'm warning about is the kind of thing that the Gentiles do, and it's just kind of a way of saying, you know, and you don't want to do that. You don't want to fall into that. But interestingly, I was thinking about this. I mean, the thing that he's warning against seems to be something that's a significant enough temptation that he is warning his Jewish disciples not to pray that way. And I think that tendency to see God as, you know, what's my big problem? The world is bigger than I am. I need rain, but I can't make the rain happen. I get sick and I can't heal myself, and, you know, these things. So what do I need? I need the powers that be to step in and take care of that stuff. And so the constant human temptation is for us to think of religious practice as a way of manipulating those forces to make them pay off for us. And I think Jesus seems to be implying that the Jews are not exempt from that, that even though they have been instructed in who God is and know that that's not how to deal with him, or that there's a lot more to him, his character, his will, his person, that still the temptation is to have the eye on, I want something, and now how can I get God to pay off? So I don't know. I guess my first thought would be, by saying this is the way the Gentiles do it, it's taking a real obvious example of it that they would say, well, of course we don't want to do that. But in warning against it, he's very much saying, you know, you could fall into the same thing and may have done that. I don't know. That's my best answer, I think.
Hasn't he said something about the Gentiles earlier? Denise, when he said something like, if you love people who love you, like,
yes,
the Gentiles do that.
Right. Yeah. Again, and that arises out of that basic Jewish thing that the Jews have this unique situation in that God has made himself known and in his law has made his will known in a very specific way, so that we have this advantage. We're in this position where we ought to be able to understand life and live it in a way that's much closer to what God wants. And the Gentiles don't have that. And I think you can see that reflected in Romans. I mean, the idea, Paul saying, you know, that the advantage of the Jews, there is this advantage that they were entrusted with the oracles of God and that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Thanks, Ron. What were you saying about there being some sort of controversial take on the daily bread issue?
Right, I was just thinking about that. If nobody came up with a question, I was going to take a minute and talk about that controversy. So,
well, I'm okay. Glad I planted myself for you.
Yes, great. So, okay, so there are a couple elements to the choice that is involved here. One of them is the word that is translated daily is one of those words that doesn't show up very much, and so we're actually kind of extrapolating, trying to figure out what it is that he is getting at. One way of translating that phrase would be, give us today the bread of tomorrow. Okay, so then what would that mean would be a question. Now, then the second part of the argument would be, as I have presented it, and I mean, I like the basic picture that I've got here. I think it's right as to what's going on. But if you look at the second and third of those requests that have to do with today, if you look at my need for forgiveness and my need for deliverance from the evil that might tempt me and destroy me, does it seem like the request for God to give me, put bread on the table for me today, does that seem like it doesn't fit in with those other two, that it's a different sort of thing? I mean, I need forgiveness and I need deliverance from temptation a lot more than I need to have food. I mean, if I don't get food, I'll die, but I'm going to die anyway. I mean, you know, that's not the most important thing. So could I see what I'm asking for in that situation doesn't seem to have that eternal implications that the other two do. So the argument is that the phrase the bread of tomorrow then could be a more metaphorical, that we're not really talking about bread, but that I'm talking somehow that ultimately tomorrow, the word that we're talking about is the day when the kingdom comes and everything is restored and so on. And so what I'm asking for today is a taste of the redemption that is going to be ultimately mine in the future. And last time I talked to Jack, that was the perspective that he was taking, something like that. And then I've talked to several of people who, over the years, who've kind of gone in that direction. And I'm sympathetic with that. I definitely think, you know, I would be really uncomfortable if the three statements were, give us this day, you know, a hot Ferrari, because you can really pick up a lot of chicks in a Ferrari, and forgive me for my sins and deliver us from evil. I would have to see it as a translation problem or something there. So how does that give us this day our daily bread fit into that? I'm thinking of it in terms of the thing that he's about to say about this not worrying in a worldly kind of way about the things of this life, about the food and that stuff, but to see myself as under the care of God, and so to entrust myself to him in that way. And I'm seeing that first request as being an expression of the trust that I ought to have regarding that. So the eternal aspect of it is not the food. The eternal aspect is that I'm acknowledging that God is the source of those things and that I'm looking to him for it. So I'm reading either one of them. You're kind of reading into it a little bit, which, you know, what is informing it in that spot. But that's the choice that's there, as I understand it right now. Okay. You know. No. No. There was this expression about sleeping dogs or something that I think was probably good advice, so I follow that. We'll see you next week.